Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Osen Curious live stream. I'm Micah Hoffman, and I am thrilled to be here with two of my friends and colleagues in the Osen industry, Christina and Jessica. We're here to interview Jessica, to talk with her about her life in Osen, skills that she has, some nonprofits that she's associated with, and her excellent work for the Osen community there, and just talk to her about her thoughts about the Osen industry. So we'll be right back with more. We're back. Welcome, everybody, to the Osen Curious live stream. As I mentioned before, I'm Micah Hoffman, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be here with two of my fabulous, very talented friends and colleagues, Christina Licati from the Osen Curious Project. How are you doing today, Christina?
Very good. I'm very happy to be here with everybody, and especially with Jessica and you, Micah. Okay, that's the standard.
And me, thank you. And we're here also with Jessica. Christina, you want to tell us a little bit about Jess?
Yes, I'm very happy you're here. Thank you for coming. I will give you a small introduction. So Jessica is the Special Investigations Lead for the National Child Protection Task Force. She also holds a master's in criminal justice and multiple certifications in OSIN, and she is also the founder of ClickSafe Intelligence, a very interesting nonprofit that we are going to talk about today. But first, I think I want to start with the question of how did you get into OSIN, because you really are involved in a lot of good things.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. This is great. I'm so honored to be here with you, with both of you. So I actually got into OSINT kind of unknowingly. I started my career with my home state's Department of Corrections, and through the wide variety of different tasks that I did for my role, I ended up having to do a lot of open source research into offenders and prior offenders who we dealt with within our caseload and our workload, and had no idea what I was doing. I did a lot of things very wrong, but it was a really good introduction into the world of OSINT. And it wasn't until I moved on to a couple of different roles in the later parts of my career thus far that I figured out, like, oh, there's a methodology and there's a science to all of this. And this is actually a thing. This wasn't just, you know, random searching that I was doing. And so I kind of got into it by happenstance, and I have not been willing to leave it since, because I love it so much.
That is an amazing thing. I hear that, and I think we all hear that over and over and over again, that we stumbled upon the field, right? Christina, you are you have a doctorate in psychology, right? A doctorate in psychology. I mean, did you know about OSINT when you were like coming up through the field, or did you just move in an area and you're like, hey, this is neat. This is called OSINT.
Actually, it's a very similar story to Jessica's in terms of how I got into OSINT. I don't have a doctorate, but I have a degree. Okay. But I mean, with all this knowledge.
I'm just going to call you that.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I started doing social engineering, and then for that work, I had to do OSINT. And I think that I always had this investigative part in my character that was really able to flourish through OSINT, and I loved it. Yeah. So I started getting more and more into it, like you did, Jessica.
Well, that's a really, really interesting point that we hear over and over again, that people, many people do start out knowing they want to go into OSINT because it is becoming more popular, but a lot of people just stumble in there. And before we go on with the interview, for those of you that are out there watching us live right now, please go ahead and feel free to send in your comments or your questions for Jessica. We'll be taking some of those. Also, if you are somebody that's watching this YouTube video after we've recorded it, please leave your comments down below, hit subscribe, and we'll make sure that we respond to this as well. For those of you on the podcast, Well, head on over to our OSINT Curious Discord, and we will make sure to answer your questions there. Scrolling along the bottom of the screen in the show notes, we have links to all of our wonderful, wonderful resources. So back to you, Jess. So Jess, when you figured out that this was called OSINT, what was your next step? Where did you go from that aha moment to I want to be in this forever?
You know, I did investigative work without it being necessarily called investigative work while I was at the Department of Corrections. And once I kind of stepped away from that to venture into the private sector, I knew that at some point I'd want to get back into that investigative work, because that intelligence mindset, that methodological research approach was something that I felt like I did well and I really, really enjoyed. So I spent a good amount of time in a wide variety of different roles, and I actually got to leverage OSINT for a lot of different types of investigations, everything from like risk assessment to, you know, looking into mergers and acquisitions and like all sorts of different things that aren't necessarily commonly connected to OSINT. And so I got to exercise my skills in a lot of different ways that I think most people probably don't really even think about when they think about OSINT. But I knew that I wanted to get back to criminal investigations. That was where my heart was, and eventually made my way back there and actually took on a role that was completely dedicated to online investigations. So I was the open source person. So all of our cases, any that needed an OSINT component would run through me. And so it was very much a drink from a fire hose sort of situation. I found every bit of training that I possibly could. I had some great internal kind of proprietary training that I went through. But then from there on out, it was kind of this like just expansion of knowledge. All of a sudden, I realized that there was so much more out there that I hadn't ever been exposed to. Was a little late to the Twitter OSINT community, which I humbly regret, because it is such a wonderful place to learn and meet people and to grow. And frankly, the education never really stops, right? Everything is constantly changing and moving, and things break and then they get rebuilt. And so it's just been this wonderful process of continuing to learn, figuring out how to continue that education while actually having to rely on your skills to execute casework for a wide variety of different endeavors. It's been awesome. And I don't, like, none of us will ever really stop learning and having to devour that knowledge to keep up our skill sets.
Yeah. I think that's one of the really good parts of OSINT, that you don't get bored. There is always something new. There is always a new case. But I'm curious, because we also have a person that is a newbie to OSINT. They want to get in. And you mentioned utilizing OSINT in different roles, which we hear a lot. There are a lot of different roles that you can have professionally and still ask to learn more about OSINT and utilize it in there. Did that previous experience and all those learnings that you got help you eventually get a job that was more OSINT focused in investigations?
Absolutely, because it's all about the methodology, right? It's about that intelligence mindset, that intelligence cycle of how you're collecting information, how you're analyzing it, how you are navigating through a problem or a question that needs to be answered. And so it doesn't necessarily matter what the end goal is or what the content focus is. It's more about the process of collecting information and determining what pieces of information are relevant to the problem that you're trying to solve or the question that you're trying to answer. So whether you're doing it for a public company, a private company, it's for a CSAM investigation or a fraud investigation or some sort of physical security intelligence, there are so many pieces that overlap within that process that any experience is good experience. And frankly, there are components of my kind of previous life when I was doing more, you know, risk-based investigations that I still rely on and exercise quite frequently when I'm doing child exploitation investigations, because you just have different lenses that you can apply to what you're looking at And, you know, you have all of these different, these palettes that you can pull from, if you will, as you're navigating through an investigation. So I say the more experience, even if it's not exactly what you want in this moment, the better. So don't shy away from it just because it's not necessarily what you want to do right now.
Yeah.
I love that you're saying that, because you can be a specialist, and we tend to specialize in one aspect in OSINT, but it's also so good to be a generalist. And again, I think it's about all this curious mentality about being OSINT curious.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what I love. And nowadays, there's so many people that are sharing their lives, their stories, their tools, their techniques through blogs, on places like Discords, or just, you know, making videos. It's easier to learn about open source intelligence tools, techniques, and innovations without necessarily having to have a credit card. So Jessica, you took that knowledge of open source intelligence and investigative processes, and then in your career, you went from where you were to a large retailer. Mm-hmm. And I think you went into cyber, is that right?
Yes, now I am in cyber. I've sat in a variety of different roles, but I'm currently a cybersecurity analyst.
And are you using OSINT in cyber for like threat intelligence type of? Aha.
Every single day. I like to tell people that I'm always the person that if you were to walk by my desk, I don't look like I'm actually working, because I just have a bunch of random social media profiles up on my screens.
Right. And probably like 250 tabs in each of your. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It's an addiction. I know.
Yep.
So what is one of your favorite things to do in OSINT? I mean, Christina mentioned that we each, you know, as we move through the progression of our careers, we find an affinity for one thing or another. Do you have anything that you really love doing? You mentioned social media. Is that it? Or,
you know, I do really love, living within the social media platforms. That tends to be where I garner the most information. And often it's not necessarily, of course, you look for your smoking guns of like, you know, somebody doing XYZ that supports the question or the problem that you're trying to solve. But I love being able to dig through textual conversations. The number of cases that I have been able to, you know, find that one missing linchpin or that one data point that I really, really needed simply by thinking through how individuals interact with social media. You know, who's the first to contact you on your birthday? Like, you know, what can you find within their rapport with an acquaintance versus a best friend versus a family member? So really digging into kind of like the linguistic psychology of how people interact with social media to be able to find things that lead you to that next piece of information, or, you know, I'm going to abandon this path and go down this path because their textual behavior is telling me to veer this way instead of this way. That is what I love more than anything else.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I'm absolutely on the same page with you in this one. And this is also where automated tools cannot really help you. And tools in general cannot help you. There are so many nuances, so many information, so much information hidden between the lines that you can only access if you really manually go through the details, the conversations, like you said. And sometimes I have people asking me, oh, you read all the conversations? You read comments? Yeah. You read the captions? And I'm like, yeah. And, you know, the question as well. But that takes time. Why don't you automate that?
Yeah.
You cannot. That's why you need humanizing OSINT.
No, we have artificial intelligence and blockchain. It's going to solve everything. I read about it somewhere. No, but, you know, one of the things that we always hear is what is your favorite tool? Now, that question's been asked by one of our viewers, and I'm going to change that, because instead of favorite tools, let's continue this thought process. What is your favorite analytical technique or thing that you do when you're analyzing that data that helps you out?
Analytical technique. That's a really good question.
I mean, it could be like, you know, talking to other people, looking back in your notes. It could be using something formal like analysis of competing hypotheses or something else. Or if it's just, you know, writing everything down and reviewing it a couple of times.
Where I tend to lean into the most is pattern and trend identification. And sometimes that's difficult because when you have a profile or an account where you don't have a lot of content to work with, you know, if you're looking at text, there isn't a lot of pattern and trend identification. But then that's where I start gravitating more towards like pattern of life and, you know, sleep versus awake times and looking into those other types of reliable behaviors where those trends and those patterns tend to develop, and being able to rely on that to either navigate to a new platform, finding additional accounts. We all say this, like humans are lazy. And so how can we explain that, right? That's a pattern. That's something that we just continue to do over and over again. It's habitual. So being able to look for those patterns and those trends and figure out like what I can do to manipulate or exploit them, that tends to be, I think, my go-to when I'm kind of going through that intelligence cycle process.
All right. So thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. All right. Well, let's move on.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. So one of the things that you do nowadays, it's on your resume and I've seen it in your LinkedIns and Twitters, is this NCPTF thing. What is the NCPTF and what do you do for it?
So NCPTF is the National Child Protection Task Force, and this is an organization that for the past couple of years has been very near and dear to my heart because we are a group of scrappy, misfit individuals who all have a heart for both investigations, intelligence, OSINT, but also for protecting and taking care of children. So we do everything from assisting law enforcement in the location of missing children to geolocating child sexual abuse material, predator identification on the dark or the open web, really anything where you have a vulnerable individual, more often than not, it's a child involved in some sort of nefarious activity, and CPTF can jump in and assist with that. And we also do training for law enforcement as well to kind of teach them all of these techniques that more often than not, they don't have the time or the resources to be able to get their hands on. So we are all things, child protection. And I have had the pleasure of sitting in the special investigations lead role. So this means any cases that have a number of different targets rather than one specific target that we have to collect intelligence on, or say it's an operation that we're going to be assisting law enforcement with over the course of multiple months. It's going to take a ton of time to be able to collect all of the intelligence they need. Anything that's really just like complex or time consuming, I am the individual that is going to help coordinate all of that intelligence gathering and making sure that it is bundled up for law enforcement in a way that it is digestible, it's easy to navigate, and then accurate, obviously, as well.
This is amazing work. I'm very glad organizations like this exist. They are also very difficult to deal with emotionally. Mm-hmm. How did you decide to get into it and utilize your OSINT skills, although you knew you would have to see some very difficult things?
You know, I ask myself that question on a regular basis, especially when the cases get really hard. I've wanted to go into the criminal justice field since I was younger. So I like to, I guess I shouldn't say I like to, but I was the weird kid that wanted to read, like, you know, Mindhunter and Obsession by John Douglas for my fifth grade book report, and got the phone calls home asking my mother if this was okay. When it comes to people who hurt other people, it's just something that I don't really have the patience for. And when you think about, you know, kids and animals, and we have subsets of individuals who are just simply more vulnerable than others, And whenever I would work a case involving a child, I mean, those are the ones that leave you with these holes in your heart and just feeling like, I want to do more, I need to do more. So when the opportunity came for me to be able to finally kind of get into this world of child exploitation in a more consistent role versus just when I had kind of dealt with this stuff back when I was with the Department of Corrections, I jumped at it. I knew that I had to spend time in this world. I knew that it had to be kind of my contribution to my, you know, my existence, my life, my contribution to the world, to this body of work that I love and I'm so passionate about. I think it was just something that I was called to do. And so now it is just a matter of, you know, fulfilling that calling. And I love it. I mean, I don't love the content, obviously, or the terrible things that I have to see, but I love being able to play a part in putting a dent in this problem and helping families. There's really no greater gift than being able to bring a child home to their family after they've been, you know, groomed into running away from home or something like that. You give somebody their life back. You give a parent their child back. I mean, I couldn't think of a better way to spend my life and my energy than doing this work.
And that's one of the things that I really like about the NCPTF is you many times get that closure. You're working directly with the law enforcement people, or you have contact with the law enforcement organizations that are going to go out and apprehend the people, rescue the victims. And so it's not a matter of, I used to work in an emergency room and patients would be wrapped up, you know, they stop the bleeding and you ship them off to another part of the hospital. And we never knew if they lived or died or what. Here, the nice thing is the law enforcement reaches back many times and says, mm-hmm. thank you for that tip, this piece of data, because that is what helped us break the case open. And there is that, you know, make it a difference feeling, which is great.
But also transferring the knowledge, because Jessica mentioned they're also giving trainings to law enforcement, transferring the knowledge, helping everybody else get on board with the potential of OSINT in solving these cases, because you only have 24 hours in a day. We all have limits as people, but being able to transfer knowledge and thus multiply the effects mm-hmm. of what we know potentially is amazing news for us, basically.
Absolutely.
And for making the good prevail, hopefully.
Like you said, Jessica, making a dent.
Making a dent. Yep, you know, exactly. That dent
bigger every day. So within the work that you with NCPTF, you mentioned gathering data and creating intelligence to hand off. Is it mostly human data? Mostly social media work that you're doing there as well, or are there other types of OSINT, like you mentioned, businesses, websites, and stuff like that might come into play, or is it mostly people?
It is mostly people because we are typically focused on trying to locate a child or locate an individual who is exploiting a child in some way, shape, or form. Oftentimes, we are focusing on that people-driven data. However, location-based data is really, really huge. So working with any sort of tools or methodologies that can help us narrow down the location of where somebody currently is, where a piece of CSAM was created. So plenty of geolocation work.
You've used CSAM twice in this interview. What is CSAM for our listeners that are not familiar?
Thank you. I kept thinking that I needed to do that and then would forget and just keep flapping. So CSAM is child sexual abuse material. Most people know it as child pornography, but we're trying to shift the narrative because pornography tends to imply a level of consent and some sort of beneficial relationship or outcome. We want to take that away, because whenever a child is involved in any sort of sexual production, whether it's an image or a video, there is not consent involved in there. And then we need to make sure that the, you know, that beneficial component is removed from that equation. So child pornography, we refer to it now as child sexual abuse material.
Thanks, Jess. So you've been working with NCPTF for over a year, right?
Yep. two plus now, I think.
Now, in your work with them, did you discover that there's a piece of this whole equation missing? Like, you know, you're finding the victims or identifying the perpetrators, but the education for the parents is not the right necessarily messaging?
Yes. So in all of the work that we do, whenever we're asked to help, whether it's geolocate a piece of child sexual abuse material or do any sort of predator identification on the dark web, whenever we would dig into the dark web and the forums that these individuals were operating on, there was this wealth of information that existed across these platforms. And what I started to notice was a lot of what was being discussed in terms of how to exploit children, how to exploit children, the best social media platforms to hang out on, the best, and, you know, different methodologies for grooming a boy versus grooming a girl. So much of that was not reflected in the current kind of like predation prevention education, whether it's hands-on or online. And so I thought, why can't we take this and mold it into the better education for these parents so they know exactly what the predators are saying? And beyond that, I also just got really tired of seeing these poor parents lose their children and say, you know, when they'd get them back, they would say, I thought we did everything right. We talked about privacy settings. We've talked about the dangers of being online, yet this still happened to us. What were we missing? And so that's how ClickSafe was born.
That's how what?
Oh, yes.
That's how ClickSafe was born.
ClickSafe Intelligence. All right.
You have to tell us about ClickSafe Intelligence. I believe the goal is to educate parents, schools, people, children, about what happens on the internet, how they could get exploited. That's it. First of all, I want you to give us an introduction into what it does. And the second question I have is also whether it talks about grooming as well, because it seems that very few organizations talk about grooming.
Yeah. So although grooming is becoming a huge buzzword right now, the methodology behind it is how an individual, a child predator, can take a child, whether they have a previous relationship with them or not, whether it's a hands-on relationship or an online relationship, and slowly and methodically get this child to a place where they are comfortable or uncomfortable, I should specify, it doesn't necessarily mean that, but where they trust this individual enough to engage in some sort of sexual activity, whether it's taking their clothes off on a webcam or whether it's letting this this predator lay hands on them. And so that is just a small part of the education that ClickSafe provides. Holistically, though, it's exactly what you've said. It is giving parents, kids, and child safety professionals education into exactly what the predators are talking about at this point in time. So what social media platforms are they hanging out on? Which ones are they, you know, engaging in successful grooming practices? Which ones are starting to fall by the wayside because we're doing a good job educating or because the kids don't hang out on those platforms anymore? And it's giving people that relevant, illustrative, example-driven information that is specific to their child and their particular place in life. You know, if you're a mom of a three-year, a mom or a dad or a guardian of a three-year-old, the information that you're going to be seeking out and that you need to keep your child safe is going to be a lot different than if you are the parent or guardian of a 17-year-old. If you are concerned about social media predation, that's going to be a little bit different than hands-on predation. And so I wanted to craft this educational mechanism that not only relied on research-driven intelligence, but also was a one-stop shop for parents to be able to kind of stay with me as their child grew and always be, you know, exactly where they needed to be in terms of, okay, this is the age and the sex of my child. This is the video that I'm going to watch. Here are the things that I need to be aware of. And hopefully we can finally put these families and these kids one step ahead of the predators for once.
Oh, wow. Yes. That would be great. Thank you for doing this. A lot of parents have the issue of wanting to have this conversation with their kids, but not knowing how to bring the topic up, how to communicate with them. It some parents might feel a bit awkward bringing this topic up. Do you get to also advise them on how to talk to their children based on their age or developmental stage?
Absolutely. So I actually have some wonderful partners who are in the child development and child psychology world. And so they are providing input on, you know, where in the sand should we draw those lines with regard to verbiage or vernacular, or, you know, even you have to even consider things like abstract thought when you're teaching some of this stuff. You know, you can't necessarily teach a topic of consent in all of the different, you know, 50 shades of gray that exist in the realm of consent to a 2 or a 3 year old. You have to teach it in more black and white terms and situations. And then as they get older, the expansion of that knowledge and that information that you're sharing with them starts to happen, right? So figuring out how to most appropriately deal with some of those really like sticky and just, you know, complex topics first and foremost, but then also like how to just create an open dialogue with your kids as well. You know, how do you create space so that your child has privacy and feels respected and empowered, but also, you know, they know that there are boundaries that they have to stay within, and those boundaries are established to keep them safe, not necessarily to make it so that you're ruining their life or something, you know, something like that. So I'm pulling knowledge from a huge network of amazing, amazing people because I don't know everything. I'm not going to pretend I know everything. You know, my degree in psychology is, you know, a bachelor's and it's over 10 years old now. So I'm not going to pretend that it's relevant enough to be able to be crafting all of this. So I'm pulling in wonderful people to help with those components of the training that maybe I don't know enough about to make sure that it's good, that it's solid, that it's strong, and it's going to be effective for parents so that they feel comfortable, they feel empowered, and the kids feel the same way when they're having those difficult conversations.
So back when I had littler kids, I remember some of the suggestions that people had or were in the literature, like, you know, just make their accounts private or make sure that they're not on like chat groups and stuff like that. Is that still relevant today, or are the predators adapting their behaviors to work around those common guidelines that we heard?
So yes and yes to both of your questions. So those are still relevant, and that's a fantastic first layer of defense. You know, keeping your child off of as many of the kind of direct chat platforms as you can is a great step. Making sure that their accounts are private is a great first step. However, we now live in this world where there's almost an expectation that you have this open account that has thousands, if not millions, of followers, and you're sharing every bit of your life with them. That's a cultural thing that exists that is really, really hard for us. You know, it's going to be turning a cruise ship. It's not going to be turning a speedboat. We have to really work to kind of like get away from that. And I don't foresee it happening anytime soon. So then comes the boundaries, right? Okay, so are you, rather than saying you can't talk to anybody that you don't know, or you shouldn't ever, you know, you have to have a private account, it becomes, well, maybe it's a touch test. So you shouldn't accept a friend request from somebody who you haven't touched on the shoulder 3 times in your life, or somebody who you wouldn't be willing or comfortable touching on the shoulder. So easier thing is you have to have met this person in person. They can't just be somebody who your friend met at camp. You have to have met them in person. So we are adding layers of complexity into what we're teaching parents and kids to be safe, because our culture around social media is changing so much. It's not great. There's not a one size fits all approach to everybody. And all of these things are going to change. They're going to be different for every child as well. So ClickSafe is a great way for parents to come do, you know, here's a checklist if you want to go that route, or just say, I just want to gut check some of the things that we're doing with our family right now to see if any of this lines up, or is there anything that we're doing that maybe falls into that really risky behavior category that we need to shift?
I guess you also have to read the person across you, the parent, the child, like the whole group of individuals you have to work with. And other than tailoring your approach to them, it is also a step-by-step process, because like you said, you can increase your level of complexity on what type of advice you offer. You can start from something you know they can accept readily, and then move to better and more complex methods, because things do get very complicated with this issue. Mm-hmm. And I had in mind when you were describing what predators do, that sometimes they are also capable of changing the narrative in a child's mind. So you might have a parent saying, look, watch out, do not talk to this person, blah, blah, blah. But then when you have a kid that is very curious, let's say, to see who this person is, they will add them on Facebook or Instagram or whatnot. And if that person starts anticipating, the predator starts anticipating what the kid's inhibitions will be, or what its parents are going to tell him, and addresses them in advance and changes the narrative and shapes what the kid thinks about these things, that can be very complicated. And I assume that this is where your examples, you said you provide some examples, this is where they prove very, very useful.
Yes, absolutely. That's a really, really great point. We can discuss kind of the grooming mechanisms in a little bit more depth here. So predators are master social engineers. They're some of the best out there. And they, because they spend so much time on this, right? They're not only sharing information amongst themselves within these predatory forums, you know, across the dark and the open web, but they're practicing it day in and day out. When you have a, you know, an online child predator or even a hands-on predator, they're not just going after one target. They have multiple targets at any given time. And it's just a constant stress test. Every conversation, every step, every engagement that they have with a child is a test. It's kind of, you know, like a, one of the, I don't know what those are called, but it's, you know, like a, if yes, go here, if no, go here sort of map that they work through. And they have figured out how to, okay, I'm getting answers that I don't like, so we're going to shift this way. And all of a sudden they have this child back in their grips, to move them in a different direction. So there's so much social engineering that goes on. And by being able to showcase parents and kids examples, it gives me something so tangible to say, like an evidence base. Like, I know that you feel like you have this figured out, but like, this is exactly what's happening here. This is how they talk. This is what they share with one another. It's not as easy to spot as you think it is. And so here are all of the different things that can happen that even adults fall for in social engineering scams. So it's not because children are underdeveloped per se, it's because these individuals are just master manipulators.
So you're actually showing parents the excerpts from dark web forums where predators are actually discussing their techniques?
Yes, absolutely. So typically speaking, everything is kind of anchored in the grooming cycle. However, there are going to be plenty of classes that speak to other things with a different focus. But it's a really, really easy way to be able to take components from these predatory conversations where they are engaging with one another, or taking screenshots from conversations that a predator is actually having with a victim, and showing the parents and the kids, you know, this is exactly what you could see, or here are all the different variations of that. Here is how, you know, this particular step in the grooming cycle, I can give you 20 different examples of what that might look like, you know, across multiple different platforms, multiple different victim types, multiple different predator types. And so much of it is very, very consistent because they leverage a lot of those same techniques.
How's that received by parents? I'm sorry for jumping in there, Christina, but you know, I'm thinking back to, you know, when my kids were little and I was very fearful that, you know, they would go to the bathroom and never come back because somebody would just take them and all. And I'm thinking if somebody showed me some excerpts from the dark web about the explicit techniques that somebody has used in the past or thinks is good to abduct a child, to abuse a child, that would hit me in several odd ways, you know, from anger to I'm going to get them, to fear for my child. What are the reactions that you're seeing from parents when you talk to them about this?
all of the things that you just mentioned, those are the reactions. And it's kind of like almost like a grief cycle. You start off being absolutely horrified, and then you kind of shift into anger. And then you get really, really sad because you're like, oh my God, there is just so much here. Like, how can I ever protect my child? And by the end of it, you're like, okay, I actually feel really empowered to be able to protect my kid. I have examples that I've seen. I have, you know, specific red flags that I can watch out for. And I have specific things that I can not only do to prevent some of this behavior, but also I know how to respond to it, you know, if it should happen to my child. So ultimately, like, I don't want to scare anybody. However, a healthy dose of fear and simply opening your eyes to the reality of this world of predation is really, really important. And you can't make an omelet without cracking a few eggs, right? So there's going to be discomfort. But at the end, the most important thing, and the reason that I do show those examples, is because I want the parents to have something tangible to walk away with. In addition to the recommendations that I give them, you need something to anchor that to, right? You can't have the, well, I'm going to go do all these things, but I don't have the context for what that is actually preventing or what I'm actually responding to. You need to know all of the nitty gritty to really be able to have a foundation on which to build the behaviors that you're going to be using to prevent and respond to predation.
So I'm curious, I'm not a parent myself, but I have observed other parents. Does this whole topic, the teaching, does it also bring back to the forefront the necessity of having open communication? Because I have seen parents having arguments with their kids, and sometimes they go like, you shouldn't be doing that. And there are other parents that, before they decide to jump in and criticize and tell their kids, do not do this, they have a moment where they stop and they think, do I want to criticize enough and advise right away, or do I want to ask my child why they want to do this, or why they feel, or just listen to them and say, do you want to talk to me about this a little bit more in a more accepting way? Does that bring the necessity of being open back, or do they feel the need to be more careful in their communication maybe?
Open and honest communication is 100%. I mean, that's going to be truly what makes all of this easier. It's going to make it more effective. And it's going to have a ripple effect, right? It's not just going to be about online safety or physical safety. It's going to be about your entire relationship with your child. And so much of the kind of recommendations and the behaviors that I say, here are some things that you can actually do, really involve the whole family as a unit. So it's not just you're laying out rules for your child. It's you as a family are establishing online safety rules that everyone in the family follows. And the kids then are empowered to call the parents out when they're not following those safety rules. Because when the kids feel like they are a part of the development of those rules, they understand that this is to keep all of us safe. And I actually have a voice. I have skin in this game. Like, I am a part of this. It's not just something that is being told to me. It's not a demand that I have to satisfy for my parents. And I have other things too. I even call them like family rules, and they're little. Sometimes they're little, sometimes they're big, but it gives the kids an opportunity to both practice and then exercise it. And the great thing is, when they feel comfortable doing it for their parents, they'll more likely do it with their friends as well, right? That's even harder than calling your parents out on bad behavior, because of just the social mores and the norms that, you know, kind of exist within adolescent development. But if they feel confident and empowered, and they feel like, all right, like, I'm in this, I'm involved, I understand why this is important, they're more likely, again, to have that ripple effect outward and be kind of a walking, talking example for the rest of their friends and their classmates and their peer group as well.
So let's talk about a couple of things that you just mentioned. Previously in this interview, you mentioned talking kind of in a community with people. Mm-hmm. You just mentioned mores and values. And we all know that different countries, different parts of the world mm-hmm. have different ways of dealing with things. We'll just put it that way.
Yes.
And so I know that ClickSafe also is just kind of getting its legs mm-hmm. under it. Are you focusing mostly on education here in the United States or English speaking countries and then going to branch out to other countries? Or have you thought of that? Or tell us what your international plans are.
I am really glad you asked because I actually have international plans. So right now the focus is on the US and English, you know, English speaking individuals, social media users, parents, families. However, I have done a lot of research into translation. How can I get my classes, which are going to be available online for download so that people can view them on their own time when it's convenient for them, how I can get those translated into other languages, but also how I can incorporate some of those cultural idiosyncrasies that exist within familial relationships, that exist within, you know, different gender identities and things like that. I've had several conversations with individuals that kind of work within the child exploitation space who have, you know, experienced child sexual abuse themselves, to be able to kind of incorporate a lot of this knowledge and this information to ensure that, you know, whatever I'm giving, you know, if I'm giving this to a family in India, or if I'm giving this to a family in France, you know, that all of those components are incorporated. There's going to be plenty that exist, plenty prevention methods and response methods that do exist across cultures. You know, open and honest communication is, I think, very important and is going to be a crux, but there are going to be little things that you have to navigate through that are going to be different from the US here. So yes, I have those plans. I'm thinking that's going to be probably around, you know, the 3 to 5 year mark that I need to start incorporating or moving in that direction. But yes, I do plan on incorporating a lot more of those international components.
Excellent. One more thing, if you had to give, and I'm going to limit you here.
Okay.
If you had to give one suggestion to parents that are listening to you on this podcast or watching this video or watching this live stream, one piece of advice to them about how best to protect themselves and their children, their family, what would that be?
I think if I could only give one thing, and this is people are probably going to go, okay, well, I already knew that, but I'm going to emphasize why it is so important. The number of individuals who have experienced sexual abuse as children and not reported it is astronomical. We have to make sure that our children know beyond everything else that they can always come to us if they feel scared or if they feel unsafe or if something is happening in their life that they are uncomfortable with. And if they don't feel comfortable going to their parents, they need to have another trusted adult, whether it is an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent, a family friend, a neighbor, somebody trustworthy that they have as a resource and a confidant to be able to go to and disclose something uncomfortable in their life. Like I said, the number of individuals who don't report child sexual abuse as kids is incredibly high. And the reason when they're asked as adults why they didn't report is because they didn't feel safe doing so and they didn't know who to tell. And so by giving them that gift of like, so-and-so is your person, you can always tell them about anything and they will help you no matter what, unconditionally, that is your person, they will help you. That may not necessarily be the greatest silver bullet in terms of prevention, but it is going to ensure that individuals get help a heck of a lot sooner and potentially prevent additional and continued exploitation down the road.
So I guess my follow-up question to that, I know I said I had one last question, but my follow-up question is, you and I both know that most of the abusers are not random people. They are
Yes.
family members. And here we're trying to tell the child, hey, you can trust the family member, you know, to essentially turn in another family member. Or what if that family member that you think as a parent is trustworthy is maybe the one that's making the child uncomfortable? Any suggestions there?
you know what? That's an entire additional podcast. So okay. If we want to book some more, no, I'm kidding.
All right, I'll book you later.
It's not cut and dry. It's not black and white, unfortunately. There are a whole host of red flags that you would have to look out for and have to kind of assess as the parent and making sure that your child chooses a safe individual. I think one of the biggest things is trusting your gut. You know, so much of one of the reasons that things don't get reported and they go on for as long as they do is because we don't want to disrupt the harmony in our lives. So if we feel uncomfortable with our child around that, you know, that one particular family member, we tend to kind of brush it off because we don't want to negatively impact that family circle. And more often than not, you know, your gut is right. So if you're uncomfortable with your child around somebody, don't let your child be around that person, and definitely don't let that person be your child's confidant, right? So yeah, there's a lot of information that goes into that, but trust your instincts. I mean, if you need or want to have more than one person that your child can go to, and that doesn't mean you're shipping your child off to have sleepovers with them every other weekend, right? It's just saying your child can go to this person for help if need be.
Yeah, but I totally understand what you're saying. You could be talking, and we could be talking with you for hours more, and you would still have things to teach us. I believe that the NCPDF, the National Child Protection Task Force, has a blog with some additional information. Your website has some additional information, I believe, ClickSafe Intelligence. Could people in the audience go read more about those issues there?
Yes, absolutely. So whether you are going to ncptf.org, you can find all of the resources, all of the links to our social media there. My website is clicksafeintelligence.com. Again, all of my social media links are there as well. And that's where I'm going to be sharing a ton of tips, tricks, resources, information, because we consume so much of our knowledge now on social media. I want to make sure that people have available, easy access to it. So go ahead and follow all of my socials, and you'll get regular updates about the business. You'll get resources, prevention tips, response tips, and I'm even including some predator quotes in there as well for you guys to see, and then what you can do about those.
I will definitely be following that, and I hope it spreads like wildfire. This is the information we want to go viral.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And Jess, like you said, you are going to be on many of the social media platforms that we're on and sharing these messages. So if we did not get a chance to answer your question, you're on the live stream, please reach out to Jessica on the social media platforms that she's on. Go to clicksafe.com and you will see that. Or we've been flashing her Twitter handle, Scarlet Sleuth, on the screen as well. Thank you for being here, Jessica, and thank you for the work that you're doing.
Yes, seriously. Thank you.
Bye.
And everybody, thank you for sharing your time with us, and stay awesome curious. Good night, everybody.